Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I'd like to welcome back a great guest co-host, Dr. Warren Perry. Welcome back to Your Health, Warren.
Thank you. I'm glad to be back.
Well, it's good to have you. We've got some really interesting conversations today with investigative journalist Catherine Jacobson Raymond about her new book, Crooked, Outwitting the Back Pain Industry and Getting on the Road to Recovery. Have you ever had back pain?
Yes, I have, actually.
Yeah, I think it's almost universal. And I'm so excited to be talking with someone who has really done tremendous research based on her own experiences. First, we've got some research that matters. And our very first one is about epidurals and labor. This is some research of a lot of women going into labor, trying to have pain control, and getting epidurals to cut down on the pain. But the question sometimes has been unanswered is, does having an epidural delay the baby coming?
Yeah, that was the question. You know, is it doing more harm than it is doing good? And what these researchers did was they basically took a group of women and they split them into two groups. One got the actual epidural. The other one got like a placebo, basically. And they each had control of it during the second stage of labor. And they actually found out when they looked at their measures that the epidural really didn't have much effect at all compared to the placebo group.
In terms of adverse outcomes, we might say, the things
exactly.
the worrisome things, because the women who had the epidurals, they had less pain. Because they took these women in at a certain point in time, half of them got this placebo, like you said, this saline, this kind of like salt water, just kind of injected. And the other half still got the pain relieving. And there was minimal differences between these two groups, but I did have some concern that they were basing this based on just 200 in each group. And there was a small difference. There was a slightly longer element of the women who had the pain medication. It was only a minute longer in that stage of labor. So, you might say that that's good and that there was no difference. You might say, well, if we saw more women, there could be an effect. We see that sometimes. You just don't have enough people in your study.
This is true.
But I think if you're a woman who's wants that epidural, you certainly have a reasonable argument, at least at this point in time, based on this research. Yeah, this was actually published in the journal called Obstetrics and Gynecology.
Yeah, I just want to know what that consent for that study was like. I don't know if I want to be one of the women who didn't get the actual anesthesia.
Yeah, you might think that there are a lot of women who said, nope, I'm just going to continue with my anesthesia versus the ones who, would have been okay. And that may change the interpretation a little bit. You might have had a select group of women who have better outcomes because they're volunteering for the study.
That's true.
Good point. Let's talk about our very next research that matters. And this is a new form of tobacco products that has really come out in Japan more than anywhere else, but may be going to other places of the world. And it's called heat not burn tobacco. Have you ever heard of it?
Actually, I have not heard of it, but I'm interested to hear more about it.
So we know that we have combustible tobacco cigarettes, and we know that they are probably on the continuum of risk, certainly much worse than other forms of nicotine delivery, like nicotine patches. We oftentimes get people off combustible cigarettes. And then we have e-cigarettes, electronic cigarettes, for which there's still a lot of controversy, but most people would say that there is less risk than the combustible cigarettes, but we don't know overall because so many people continue to use e-cigarettes and still some combustible cigarettes. And so there's this kind of a next generation called this heat not burn. And it is tobacco leaf in there, but it's not lit. It's just heated enough to give the flavor and to absorb the nicotine. So it's another nicotine delivery device for which, of course, the manufacturers, which are the tobacco companies, Philip Morris being one of the largest who has the major product here, claim that it will have significant health benefits. What did they find in this particular study?
Well, I think what they are trying to basically say in the study is that even though they appear to be healthier, do we actually know that they are healthier? You know, I guess without the thick smoke, it's still a foreign body that you're inhaling. So there has to be some type of effect. And so a lot of health organizations are concerned that they're put out and marketed as being healthier when actually we don't really know that.
Yeah. And in Japan, the interest in these products grew exponentially. So they were claiming, and the researchers, that these products would overtake electronic cigarettes in terms of interest by the public. And, I applaud the interest by the public to go off combustible tobacco products. I applaud efforts at innovation to move people off combustible tobacco products. But I think you're absolutely right. Here there's concern that this is tobacco. We know that tobacco has many carcinogens, cancer-causing agents, some of which are with combustion, but some are inherent within the product and the heating of the product. There may well be some threshold. I don't think we have long-term effects on this to know that it would be safe. I think it's still going to be regulated and should be like other tobacco products. Let's talk about our last research that matters, and it's about teaching and fighting racism and how to get our kids not to have the implicit bias, which is they see a non-white child sees a black child and they have just a bias, even they've never met a black child or know a black child, not the explicit bias that may come from their parents, but just something that they see something really different than themselves.
So this research was actually a Chinese study. And basically what it did, it took a group of Chinese kids and it had them look at people from different races and just give a connotation toward them. And they found out that the black race had the most negative connotation. So they split the children up into three groups and then they gave them pictures of five people from who were white, five who were black, and five who were Chinese, I believe.
Yeah.
And then for a session, they just had them, I forget exactly what they did. They had them basically just like talk about them individually.
Yeah, because they would know who they are.
Exactly. Get to know them, I guess you could say, and kind of simulate that. And they found that after two sessions with the group that had the black faces, they were able to decrease the negative connotations. Whereas for the other groups, they still stayed the same.
Yeah, I think this is actually important research. This was published in the journal Child Development. And I think that we have to be exposed to people different from us, and we have to be, and the earlier that that's started, the better it is, because I think of all race, ethnicities, culture, we have to be more tolerant, and we have to be understanding of the other and really know that we can get rid of explicit biases, but we may have these implicit ones that are really difficult to change. I like this research.
Yeah, I really think it simulated a lot of what goes on in the world.
Yeah, so I hope you'll read about it and let us know what you think. Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with investigative journalist Catherine Jacobson Raymond about our new book, Crooked, Outwitting the Back Pain Industry and Getting on the Road to Recovery. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Golson and Dr. Warren Perry. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Warren Perry. Today on Conversations, Warren, we're talking with investigative journalist Catherine Jacobson Raymond about her new book, Crooked, Outwitting the Back Pain Industry and Getting on the Road to Recovery. Welcome, Ms. Raymond.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
You know, we always like to know, obviously, about the topic and the book, but we're even more interested in the person behind both. Tell us a little bit about yourself, and how did you get interested in both investigative journalism and writing books about back pain?
Well, I have been an investigative journalist for almost 4 decades. So this goes way back. I think that really got started when, I was just, even as a child, determined to get to the bottom of things and somewhat of a bulldog. And that really has never gone away, much to the frustration of certain family members, etc. So I had written a book previously called Carved in Sand. It's a book about midlife memory and what happens to it. And everyone always says, right, nothing good, huh? And I go, well, you know, you're going to need to read the book. And I had been on a speaking engagement tour for about 18 months, and my back, which had always been a problem from the time I was about 16, was getting worse and worse. And my leg was really bothering me. There was considerable weakness. And I was really thinking that I was not going to be able to write another book or even start another project until I figured out what I was going to do about this. And mind you, I'd been working on it for years in various ways. I had tried all forms of exercise, several rounds of standard sort of cookie cutter physical therapy. I'd done just about, you know, everything that one could from a conservative care perspective. I hadn't had any injections or an MRI or any of those, but I was determined now that I was going to do something. I was going to get this fixed, as so many of us are. We are going to get it fixed by someone else, right? And as I began to see doctors and proceed through the process to sort of get on that medical merry-go-round, the investigative reporter surfaced, and I started to say, wait a minute, what is going on here? Which, by the way, is sort of a constant refrain throughout my life. You know, what is going on here exactly? Would someone please explain it, because it isn't making sense? And I realized that a great deal of what was being offered to patients was without evidence, which is bad enough, but in fact, there was significant harm being done. And when I caught on to that, and I realized how many people jumped on this merry-go-round and wound up having spine surgery that didn't help them and often harmed them, then I began to strongly suspect that I had my next project on my hands. So I still had a lot of back pain, but I also had a new book project, and somehow the two of those were going to have to work together. There was just no question about it.
That sounds like a very interesting anecdote to lead you to your book. Can you give the listeners a idea of how common back pain is and just the burden it has financially, and then how successful people are with ridding themselves of it?
Just about 80% of people experience back pain at some point in their lives. It's, you know, it's sort of a very ordinary part of living. The numbers of people who go on to experience chronic pain, I really don't think we have good numbers, because they vary enormously depending on who's collecting them. For instance, if an opioid manufacturer would like to collect those numbers, they'll look very, very different than if, say, a physical therapy group is collecting them, or if a chiropractic group is collecting them. You'll get different numbers across the board. But it does seem to be that about a quarter of people who have one back pain episode go on to have another and another and another. And once you've had two, you know, you're very likely to have more unless you find a really good means of intervention. And as I explain repeatedly in my book, Crooked, that is not going to be something done to you by somebody else. You're going to have to take this into your own hands. In terms of the financial burden, the numbers that are being used and that I use in the book are $100 billion a year.
Wow.
People go, whoa, how can it possibly be that much? Well, you have to think beyond the pure medical costs, which are certainly bad enough, but in terms of disability costs to companies, to the Social Security Administration, which is in charge of SSDI, Social Security Disability Insurance, and all the associated costs of insurance and private health insurance, et cetera, it really, really mounts up. And there's, you know, obviously lost time at work, et cetera, in that $100 billion number. But what really struck me as amusing was over the course of writing the book, which took about 9 years, by the way, multiple editors and other people involved in the project would change that $100 billion to $100 million, and they'd send me an email or something with that, and I'm like, no, $100 billion a year, because it just seems inconceivable. But it's actual, And it's more costly than pretty much any other disorder that we experience here in the U.S. At this point, you kind of have to throw in the cost of opioid deaths and overdoses and what that is costing cities, counties, municipalities of all types, and hospitals, et cetera. Those numbers, you'd like to see them coming down, but I do believe it's going up.
Well, you know, I think it's important. You know, the first part of your title of your book is Outwitting the Back Pain Industry. Tell us exactly what you mean. I think you're alluding to it. It's a $100 billion problem. A lot of it is an industry, according to your book. Tell us what you mean
by
that.
When you hit $100 billion, I really think that's an industry. Why I say it's an industry? Well, there are really dozens of stakeholders in this industry. There are pain management doctors, pain medicine doctors, chiropractors, physical therapists, surgeons, insurance companies, hospitals, device manufacturers, pharmaceutical manufacturers, work comp insurers, a whole battery of legal people who are associated with legal profession and personal injury. This is really an enormous industry, and it would be great if patients generally got better. But that is not the reality. They do not generally get better. And I've had many, many people, as you know, I'm an investigative reporter. I'm not a physician or any other type of practitioner. But I've had many people say to me, you know, I have no other option. Surgery is my last option. It's the only thing left for me. And I have had to explain over and over again that surgery is never the only option left to you, because it's very, very rare for spinal fusion surgeries to be very successful. They may be deemed successful potentially by the surgeon, who will say, look, here's the x-ray and the fusion is there. It's intact. It's just what we wanted. But very frequently, those people do not get back to work. They are very often still need to take painkillers, or feel that that's the only way through. And it is very rarely a successful strategy for most patients. Now, there are exceptions to that, and I discuss them in the book in detail. I don't want anyone to think that, you know, no spinal fusion surgery has ever worked, because in cases where we're dealing with congenital problems, deformity, et cetera, tumors, infections, that is frequently necessary, absolutely necessary.
And most of us who see patients know of dozens of our patients who've had disc problems who ultimately went on to surgery, many of whom their pain was only relieved after that. So we know that that's different than chronic back pain, a lot of which is in your book. But we're going to need to take a short break. And when we return, we'll continue talking with investigative journalist Catherine Jacobson Raymond about our new book, Crooked, Outwitting the Back Pain Industry and Getting on the Road to Recovery. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Warren Perry. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we've been talking with investigative journalist Catherine Jacobson Raymond about our new book, Crooked, Outwitting the Back Pain Industry and Getting on the Road to Recovery. And right before the break, Ms. Raymond, you were talking about your experiences, I guess really starting with your own search for back pain that you were experiencing, and really kind of a frustrating large industry that you discovered is very intimidating perhaps to patients. I'm reading between the lines a little bit, but yet it seems to be a plethora of treatments. Tell us how you started figuring out what didn't work or might not work for you, at least.
Well, I will tell you that patients who are in pain, and that would be true of back pain patients, of course, tend to make very poor decisions. when you're in pain and perhaps, you know, you're trying to take care of a family, you have a ton of work to do, et cetera, you get so desperate that I used to say that I would have hopped on a gurney in Times Square if I thought that would take care of the problem. You'll do practically anything anyone suggests without really considering the reality of it. And, you know, I was just like everyone else in this regard, which is kind of amusing given that, you know, I'm an investigative reporter and my middle name is Skeptical. But I was in enough pain and anxious enough about what the future held. And so I began by going to see my primary care doctor. And he said, you know, I'd like you to do another round of physical therapy. And I said, you know, I have done physical therapy 3 times and it has not helped me at all. And I really don't feel like I have the time to do this again. And he said, okay, well, maybe I can offer you, this is, mind you, 9 years ago or 10 years ago, so we didn't know what we know today about opioids, or at least we claim not to know what we know today about opioids. And he said, well, maybe we can just get you some painkillers to get you over the hump. And I said, you know, but the hump has lasted since I was 16, and it's only getting worse, so I can't take painkillers. I've just written a book about memory and attention, and I'm not about to ruin it with painkillers. So that's not good either. And he said, okay, well, then I guess I'm going to send you around the corner to the orthopedic practice, and you'll have, you know, you'll have an x-ray, or maybe I better just send you for an MRI right now. So, of course, I opted for that. And the MRI came back, and I heard from his nurse practitioner that there were some dark discs, there was degenerative disc disease. And of course, like anybody who hears that news, I got very concerned. I heard degenerative disc disease. It sounds as if your spine is falling apart, and nobody takes that well. And I went back in to see him, and he basically read me the radiologist report again and sent me, my primary care doctor, that is, sent me to the orthopedist's office. And I describe what happened there in great detail in Crooked and my numerous trips to see different orthopedists and why they didn't work out, and ultimately my rather misguided decision to go to a clinic where minimally invasive spine surgery was performed, quote-unquote laser cutting-edge spine surgery. And what I experienced there, it's a very lovely environment, very kind people, terrific kind of patient bedside manner, but unfortunately the work they do there is not successful for a very large number of people who go there. It may be successful for some, but in my screening later of patients who had been there, that is not what I found.
You mentioned a good point when you were talking about your plan, you know, the MRI versus surgery. For patients who are having back pain, what are the questions they should be asking? How would you advise them on feeling comfortable with the plan of action for their back pain?
What I think is the greatest hurdle is there's a real inclination when a physician says to a patient, you know, I cannot help you with this in terms of surgery. That patient's assumption is usually, I'm going to have to continue to look. And eventually, somebody's friend will say, well, go see Dr. So-and-so, you know, and there are surgeons out there who do an enormous amount of surgery and who are pretty much willing to take on any case they think they might help, whether or not there's any basis for thinking that. So this happens. It happens all the time. And I feel like the first thing that you need to be thinking about is, what is the reality of your program thus far? You may have been to physical therapy for several sessions, as I had several different times, and have gotten nowhere. So that's something to consider. Now, as a patient, if you don't do the exercises, surprisingly enough, they don't work. And if you cheat, and nearly all back patients do cheat, and you don't do them really properly, they also don't work. So I found, it was my experience, that to really get past the chronic stage of back pain, to be able to manage my own back, I really needed help. And that's why we have chapters in this book called Back Whisperers and Posture Mavens. And that's when I talk about specific types of programs and exercises that many people have found very, very successful. And I knew that this was the case, of course, when I was researching the book. But since the book's come out, I have received hundreds of emails from people who tell me that indeed this is how they recovered. They pursued a conditioning program that really, really helped them. And what I have concluded is that, you know, cranky backs, they don't need rest. They really don't. They need exercise. And that is, for so many people, absolutely counterintuitive, because when you're in pain, what you want to do is lie down on a heating pad and watch TV. You do not want to get on the floor and do exercise. I know I have been there myself, you know, many times, and it is can be very, very challenging, but it's remarkable that after you proceed through some exercises that are meant to really work the muscles of the back that have decided that they are off duty, people feel much, much better.
Catherine, I would have to agree with you. Definitely, I had injured my back a couple weeks back. And actually, it's like a month ago, and I've never injured my back before. I guess I hit age 30 and, you know, things was going downhill. But I remember, like, just being in so much pain. I remember going to the gym one day and thinking to myself, after I get out of the gym, I know I'm going to regret this. But I actually felt better. I think moving around helped out my lower back. And I think, you know, not sitting down for long periods of time helped out my lower back. And I would notice it more again when I got up from, like a nap or, like, for sleeping overnight.
We have one final question I really want to ask you about, just how the brain has to really function. But I do want to ask you, Ms. Raymond, and again, we're talking about kind of these acute injuries or maybe some more chronic back pain, not the a cancer sort of thing on the spine. Chiropractic care.
Chiropractic care in my book, there's half a chapter dedicated to that topic. Now, there are chiropractors who have walked away from traditional approaches and have become really focused on rehab. They're very good at it. They've made a study of it. These chiropractors can be very helpful. However, there are many chiropractors who are still correcting imaginary subluxations that cannot be tracked in any way on any x-ray or in any other way. And studies have shown repeatedly that patients are not helped after one or two sessions with them. Now, unfortunately, they often want to sign people up for, you know, a year's worth of treatment or months and months worth of treatment. And there's just absolutely no indication for that. Now, the American College of Physicians recently came out and noted that a number of types of manual therapy can be helpful, and chiropractors did appear on that list. So, you know, when this piece airs, you'll have plenty of chiropractors saying, hey, I'm on the list. Well, it's a bit complicated and long to get into, but it's chiropractic in comparison to other treatments that are also ineffective. So I would not suggest anyone rush out to sign up for extended care with a chiropractor, a traditional chiropractor. Aim for the rehab people.
So in the last minute, tell us what your brain really does have to do with your back. And it seems like that's a major part of your own efforts to be really healthy as far as your back is concerned.
Well, it is. The brain has a great deal to do with it. There is a definite relationship between back pain and anxiety and other, you know, emotionally trying experiences. And so one needs to take that into account. Some people get migraines, some people get stomach problems, some people, you know, have all kinds of different physical problems. But for many of us, tension and distress turns up in the low back, certainly true for me. And it's really important to be aware of that. Exercise to a large extent can override that problem. So it's worth it to pursue it. And I know it's a bit vague, but if you get to read the book, you will see what the specific opportunities for exercise are. There are further neurological sequelae that should be considered here. There is a condition that is called centralized sensitization. And that means that the problem appears to be in your back, but in fact, your brain has taken over the job of constantly discussing pain with you. And it is very challenging to overcome central sensitization problems because this really must be done once again through exercise. There's certainly surgery on a disc or a vertebrae will not be helpful if the problem is, in fact, in the brain.
Well, we're going to make a link to your book on our website. We appreciate you sharing your experience. We're glad you're doing better. Your path is one that can be useful for, thousands of patients across the country and internationally. So thank you for your work and time.
Well, thank you very much for talking about it with me.
We've been talking with investigative journalist Catherine Jacobson-Raymond about our new book, Crooked, Outwitting the Back Pain Industry and Getting on the Road to Recovery. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Warren Perry. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health for the House Call segment of our show today. Warren and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. And Warren, if a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question today about someone who's worried about getting clots while traveling. Laura?
I'm in my early 40s, and my family has a history of DVT. I travel a lot for work, sometimes on long flights, and I'm wondering if I should be doing anything while I travel to minimize the risk of blood clots.
Well, you're not alone in worried about blood clots on flights, and I've seen a fair number of patients. You probably, Warren, have seen them too. They probably show up in the emergency room even sometimes before they come to my clinic with blood clots having recently traveled, whether it's a long car ride or a plane ride.
Yeah, this is true. Yeah, they normally come complaining of either leg swelling or pain in their leg, but it's a common fear that a lot of people have. And I think it's a healthy fear that you should have too as well. If you're looking for things you can do to decrease your risk of getting a blood clot, the kind of the environment that potentiates these things are states where you're not really moving blood in your leg. So by getting up and walking on the plane every now and then might help you out a little bit to get that blood circulating. Or if you can't get up in the plane, at least just moving your legs up and down and getting the blood circulating through your calves and your thighs would be a big benefit.
Maybe you can get into first class. Get your doctor to write
you some leg room, exactly.
A doctor's note, because you know that you get so much leg room, and you know it is important. And of course, flying, it's a little scary sometimes to get up on a plane, given all the things sometimes in the movement and everything. Mm-hmm. But it is important to certainly do some leg exercises. You could do kind of where you pull your toes back to you and forward, mm-hmm. bending your knees. I think very much doing some exercise, even if you're sitting down, but preferably getting up and doing some walking. You certainly said you have a family history of deep venous thrombosis, DVT. I'd like to know what exactly, is there a genetic syndrome that goes in your family? Because then you might be at extra risk and it might be worth doing. And then also see what kind of medicines you're taking. You know, certain medicines, could increase the risk. Certain medicines may decrease the risk. Certainly worth talking with your primary care doctor.
Yeah, I would agree.
Laura, what's our very next house call?
I recently had a blood test done, and the doctor said that I was in metabolic acidosis. She recommended that I get the test redone in a day or two, implying that if the results were the same, it could be serious. The results actually were normal the second time around, but it made me wonder what metabolic acidosis is and what the risks are.
Well, I think that I'm sorry that you got a false positive test. The test was positive, but it was really a false test result. The problem is that lots of test results, particularly if you're doing lots of tests, you're going to get a false positive. And someone who's really healthy, it'd be unusual for them to get metabolic acidosis, which is basically you got too much acid in your bloodstream. That's not a good thing.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. It's not a good thing, and I think your primary care physician was rightfully so to be concerned and wanted to have follow-up blood work, but I think she was afraid that you would be in the extremist part of metabolic acidosis, which, judging the fact that she sent you home, I doubt that was the case for you. But it could have been, a false positive. It could have been that you hadn't really eaten much that day, and so you had a little bit more acid in your body than normal. But, the fact that it normalized is reassuring.
some medicines, one common medicine given for diabetes called glucophage or metformin, you sometimes have to worry about people can get buildups of acid, but only when they're really sick. Typically, if you have a metabolic acidosis, you have something else going on that may make you sick, like kidney disease of some sort. But if you don't have kidney disease, you're not on medicine for diabetes, you're pretty healthy, it probably was a false positive. Good luck. Thank you very much for that question. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I have a friend who recommended that I start taking fish oil. Are supplements like this really beneficial, or are all these recommendations really just the modern version of an old wives' tale?
Well, one of the best things to do is to ask a doctor, what do they think for themselves about fish oil? I mean, because, you know, depending on what it is, if I ask you, what do you do for back pain? If you've ever had back pain, you can say what I did, and that usually sometimes is a helpful. So fish oil, though, I think there's a lot of data that suggests that there is more benefit than harm, and not much data that shows there's much harm. That's my own opinion.
Yeah, no, I recommend that my mom takes it. I should be taking it, but I'm not. But I think after doing my little research for this question, I think I'll probably put it in my little pill box in the morning.
Well, and there's lots of ways of getting the recommended amount of fish oil. Clearly, we should separate out those who, for instance, have very high triglycerides in their bloodstream. That comes from diet and genetics. And sometimes the fish oil is really used to treat that particular condition. This is different from people who want to get a benefit of fish oil either because they're at risk for heart disease or maybe they have had heart disease and they want to get some benefit. A lot of times the amount of fish oil one can take in those circumstances, one could get from your diet by having a serving of fish that is high in fish oil, you know, a couple times a week. So it doesn't mean you have to take pills.
This is true.
But yeah. You could take a pill.
Yeah, if you're not getting that in your natural diet.
Right. Maybe you don't like fish. Do you like fish?
I do like fish.
Yeah, me too. I try to have it several times a week. So a lot to be done here. We'll ask our great health sciences librarians to actually put up a link to some really good medical data on fish oil and where perhaps certain fishes, how much fish oil they can actually get in there. And I think a lot of times people are talking about 250 milligrams a day that they may need, not necessarily the 2,000 grams a day. And sometimes they may want even go up to a gram a day, not the type that you need when people again have high triglycerides. They need 4 grams a day. Mm. Laura, what's our very last house call?
After a bout of stomach pain, I recently was diagnosed with gallstones. My doctor gave me a medication to treat them, but I'm wondering if I should push back to have my gallbladder removed. What do you think?
Well, it's unfortunate you have gallstones. I know that can be a very painful and frustrating thing to have, but I think you're right to question the therapy. So the way I go about this with my patients, and I normally see patients again extremists, but a lot of them come with just complaints of just gallstones, just like hurting their belly whenever they come after they eat. I tell patients, you know, go very conservative first. Try the medications first. Try changing your diet, because sometimes your diet can play a huge role in people who have gallstone pain or gallbladder pain. A lot of fatty foods aggravate it. And so if you can avoid those foods and change your diet, that might alleviate your symptoms enough that you don't have to be on medications. If it continues to be there, try medications. Normally, the point at which people opt to do surgery is when they've basically exhausted all options up until that point, or you get a possible infection secondary to the fact of having gallstones.
The problem with some of the medications is, first of all, there's not a lot. If you have a cholesterol gallstone, these medicines help to dissolve cholesterol. And the only one on the market is called UDCA, or hard one to say, ursodeoxycholic acid. Say that 3 times real fast. But you have to be the right patient at the right time. It has to be a very small stone size, less than a centimeter. So you'll need an ultrasound of that. It has to be very mild symptoms. You can have a lot of pain there. You have to have an open duct where the gallbladder drains from so that it can actually, the medicine can get there and it can dissolve. The gallbladder actually has to be highly functioning and there can't be much calcification in there. So a lot of people, and then even then, it's only about 40 to up to, you know, 60, 80% effective. So, and the medicine can cost up to $1,000. So in this particular case, a lot of times the surgery actually ends up being what's done. But for some people, the surgery may not be the best thing.
No. I mean, again, it's all preference. It's all about talking to your primary care doctor and your surgeon if you have one, deciding what's the best plan of action.
Well, that'll conclude our house calls today. And we want to thank all of you for joining us today for Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to you. You can send your own questions to yourhealth@unc.edu and visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, my co-host, Dr. Warren Perry, and our guest today, Catherine Jacobson Raymond. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
I'm Dr. Warren Perry.
We look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.